Next case is 00771, Community Insurance Company versus Ohio Department of Transportation. Mr. Blomgren.
Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Gilbert Blomgren, and I represent the Pelham Community Insurance Company in this appeal. With the Court's permission, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time on the clock.
The Pelham, acting in its capacity as administrator of the Central News Corporation Employee Benefit Plan, paid on behalf of a covered individual, Rochelle Norbar, the total sum of $245,103.55 for medical and hospital expenses incurred as a result of a one-car automobile accident on March 16, 1992. Appellant and Dronebarger filed separate lawsuits against Appellee ODOT in the Court of Claims based upon Appellee's negligent failure to maintain a utility pole in conformance to applicable ODOT standards. Ultimately, Appellant was awarded his paid claim total reduced by 40%.
Counselor?
Yes.
We've read the briefs and we understand the facts, and I wonder if we can get right to the law.
Thank you, Your
First thing I'd like to go directly to, I think it's interesting, instructive, and maybe other adjectives that I choose not to use. I see an insurance company citing the Ohio Academy of Trial Lawyers versus Shure. That's wonderful. All of a sudden, the insurance company sees that why the case maybe came out, right?
It was for a limited purpose, Your Honor.
All right. Now let me go to the second issue, which is more important. You don't discuss, and I'm going to ask your worthy adversaries this because they have some pretty sweeping statements in their brief, but you don't discuss, and nobody's come before us and discussed, the second paragraph that just sort of seems to be stuck into the Constitution in Article 1, Section 16. So my first question is, not allowing this subrogation, isn't that a form of immunity?
Well, Your Honor,
And that's really what they claim in their brief, that whenever the state gave up its sovereign immunity, that in fact it was limited, and they had a right to limit it this way.
Well, Your Honor, I have absolutely no dispute with the point that the state has a right to limit its sovereign immunity under the legislature.
You don't?
No, the legislature has waived its immunity.
Wait. The legislature has waived its immunity. You're saying that the state did not have immunity, or the state did have immunity. What are you saying?
I'm sorry.
You said the legislature waived the immunity. So you're saying the state was immune.
That's right.
Well, then why does Article 1, Section 16, in the second paragraph, that again is bracketed and says suits against the state, says suits may be brought against the state?
Right.
Comma, only subject to the terms and conditions, meaning the Court of Claims.
Yes, it absolutely says
the Constitution says the state can be sued.
Right.
How can that be any sovereign immunity?
Well, the legislature has expressed, again,
legislature can't say we're waiving sovereign immunity that you never had. The Constitution says the state can be sued.
Right. And the legislature has expressed the means and the circumstances under which the state may be sued is separate from a private party claim.
Right. Where they can be sued, can they limit the suits?
Yes, absolutely.
How? When it says the state may be sued in the Constitution.
Well,
you and I are just going to disagree about that, so let's just stop.
Let me take you to a statutory question about 02. Doesn't your argument require us to consider the insurance company to be a claimant under 02? That's the way I read your argument.
Well, Yes, that's right. We're claiming under O2, that's absolutely correct.
Give me your strongest argument on that point. I'm having difficulty accepting that. Let me hear your strongest argument.
All right. Well, there were two claimants in this case, okay? Rochelle Dornbarger against the Ohio Department of Transportation and Community Insurance Company. I've also claimed against the Ohio Department of Transportation. Two separate parties, two separate lawsuits, which were later consolidated, filed against the Ohio Department of Transportation. Neither claimant, Your Honor, so this is what I want to stress. The only reduction in the recovery was for comparative fault. There was no reduction for either award for any recovery received by claimant, Community Insurance Company, for any recovery from...
I think you're answering the question by... I think the statute says recoveries against the state shall be reduced by the aggregate of insurance proceeds. That sounds to me like it's a person who's injured as a result of a telephone pole or a pole that hurts them somehow. Isn't that okay? They get insurance proceeds, a disability award, or other collateral recovery received by the claimant. Now that you there, you think the claimant is can be the insurance company or an insurance company that
is
paid.
It's simply the case that the claimant, Community Insurance Company, has received no recovery as to its paid claims from any aggregate of insurance proceeds, disability awards, or other collateral recovery.
Why does
no collateral recovery reducing Community Insurance Company's paid claim fault? That's the key to my argument. We're a claimant under the statute. There's nothing in the Court of Claims Act or anywhere that says we cannot be a claimant under the statute, just as Rochelle Dornbarger was. And we did not receive any collateral recovery from some other carrier, some other source other than Community Insurance Company. So our claim stands. We're claimants and we're entitled to a certain claim. Just as Rochelle,
I guess, let me tell you what my problem is. It seems to me as if the statute is written with the focus on the person who receives the physical injury as a result of some negligence by the state, and that it does not anticipate that an insurance company can say, well, we've somehow been economically harmed by whatever happened, but that the statute is written as if it's only concerned about, you know, the state makes an error, whatever it is, negligence, and somebody's hurt by that, and they're the claimant.
Right, but there's nothing that would prevent Community Insurance Company or some other insurance company claimant from being a claimant under the statute. The court dealt with this issue in the Lumberman's decision. The previous decision was overruled in this case, where what the court was saying was, look, the insurance company is a real party in interest as to its subrogated claim. The insurance company has a right and must assert its claim in its own name, as was done here, and therefore, there's no issue of collateral recovery. Subrogated claim is simply the assigned portion of the insurer's claim. Now, my argument, Your Honor, is not that the legislature could not craft a constitutionally permissible scheme for barring subrogation claims. It clearly did so in 2744.05b. There, the language of the statute is clear. There is no subrogation claim allowed. I mean, it's spelled out in the statute. No insurer or other person is entitled to bring an action under a subrogation provision. That language is conspicuously absent under 2743.02d. Now, that's what the Lumberman's decision focused on. And Justice Holmes said, look, maybe the legislature was doing what the Attorney General's office is suggesting, but in his concurring opinion, he said, it does not say that in the statute. There is no language barring a subrogation claim found in revised law 2743.02d. Community Insurance Company is a real party in interest as to its claim. This is court has decided in previous cases, like I cite Sheely versus Campbell, where an insurance carrier paid the entire amount of judgment is the only real party in interest, the sole real party in interest as to its claim. Upon payment, Community Insurance Company became the real party in interest to its claim. It's a claimant under the statute. There would have received absolutely no amount of aggregate insurance proceeds, disability awards, or other collateral recovery. So the claim simply proceeds, and why revised code 2743.02d has no application, as the court indicated in Lumberman's. It just simply doesn't apply to the situation. Now, in order for a court to interpret a statute, there must be some ambiguity alleged. There's been no ambiguity alleged in this case. As the 10th District commented, applying the same statute at issue, I might point out, Ohio Revised Code 2743.02d, and finding insurance proceeds includes life insurance proceeds, the court had this to say. The 10th District, it is axiomatic that words and phrases used in statutes are to be given their plain and ordinary meaning, absent evidence to the contrary. An unambiguous statute is to be applied, not interpreted. Now, Your Honors, I submit that the 10th District did not follow its own injunction, is interpreting ORC 2743.02D, the ban on subrogation claims, when that is not found in the statute, that language is not found in the statute. It is not applying the statute as written, which would allow a community insurance company to be a claimant. There's been no reduction for any recovery from a collateral source and allowed to recover his claim. As Justice Bryan points out in dissent in the 10th District decision, there are important reasons for preserving the collateral source rule. Now, there's no question that 2744.05B abrogates the collateral source rule. The 10th District has held this 2743.02D, despite the fact that it lacks the land and car subrogation claims, it's found to be essentially the same, and saying we're going to abrogate the collateral source rule. The collateral source rule serves important evidentiary and substantive purposes. As a substantive purpose, the collateral source rule is an exception to the general rule, the measure of plaintiff's damages is that which would make the plaintiff whole. The collateral source rule allows the injured plaintiff to receive more than the amount of damages actually received. The rationale is the rationale is that benefits plaintiffs receive from a source wholly independent of the wrongdoer should not benefit the wrongdoer by reducing the amount of damages which plaintiff might otherwise recover. As an evidentiary purpose, it bars the introduction of the evidence of collateral payments to present jury considerations of payments in determining the amount of damages. Judge Bryan stressed the importance of these dual purposes. She could find no reason why the 10th District would abrogate the collateral source rule in the absence of any statutory language doing so, as is found in 2744.05B. Now, the court also, the lower court has adopted the cases interpreting the class of 2744.05B, which, as I commented, contains no prohibition against subrogation claims. It's another separate statute, but the court has said it's essentially the same, so we're going to apply the same analysis. I submit that even if the 10th District is correct, that ORC 2744.05B is essentially the same, the analysis applies. The effect of that application has been incorrectly set forth by the 10th District. In Street v. Cincinnati, a 1995 case decided by this court, the court considered whether benefits, if used in 2744.05B, included monies advanced to an injured party by a union benefit plan that must be reimbursed from a subsequent judgment under a subrogation agreement between the injured party and the plan. Now, the court held that the amount received by the plaintiff in the union benefit plan was not a benefit, but a conditional loan paid to Street contingent upon successful recovery against the third-party tort fees. In this particular case, community insurance company, the party with the subrogation interest, was a party to the lawsuit, but the obligation to reimburse, Your Honors, still exists. I would direct Your Honors to the reimbursement language found in the certificate of benefits of the plan. It provides, if you recover damages from any party or through any coverage named above, you must hold in trust for us. The proceeds of the recovery must reimburse us to the extent of payments made. Now, it's been suggested that insurance companies can adjust premiums and insurance companies are best able to bear the loss and so forth. But I submit to you that it's the injured party will bear the loss because just as in the Street case, there's an obligation to reimburse found in this plan. And it does not say if you recover damages for medical bills. It says if you recover damages from any party. So even though Rochelle Dornbarger wasn't able to recover her medical bills in this case, the obligation to reimburse remains. So as a policy matter, I'm suggesting that the waiver of sovereign immunity was not intended in 2743.02D. There's nothing in the Court of Claims Act to suggest that state entities should not be held accountable for the full cost of their torts. Okay? 2743.02D protects against multiple recoveries over and above. Doesn't allow a claim to recover twice. But what I'm asking the justices to do is to interpret the statute as written not interpreted as borrowing subrogation claim, and the language is not held, the language is not found in that statute. I've got a couple minutes left for my rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Blomgren. Ms. Sullivan.
Good morning. My co-counsel, Mr. Becker, and I are pleased to appear before the court this morning. This case is not about whether an injured party can recover for her damages, because she has recovered. And it's not about any constitutional issue. It's simply about this. As between an insurance company and the state, who shall bear the excess that was covered by an insurance contract? The legislature could choose to say that part of the claim should be borne by the profit-making insurance industry in this case. The issue in this case involves a straightforward application of the same well-settled principle of subrogation law that this court applied in its case of Galanos versus City of Cleveland, and that is that an insurer steps into the shoes of its insured. As the insurance company has repeatedly admitted during the course of this litigation, it had no better rights than its insured, Ms. Dronebarger, and could only recover what she could recover. Therefore, we contend that the 10th District correctly overruled its 24-year-old decision in the unreported Lumbermans case. Lumbermans was wrongly decided because it failed to consider the well-settled law of subrogation and failed to consider the policy behind the state's waiver of sovereign immunity.
Then, in fact, by saying that subrogation claim can't be made, the court, in effect, or the argument is that that is a form of immunity. The state is immune to that degree.
That's correct.
All right. On page 6 of your brief, at the bottom, you start, when the state waived its immunity and consented to be sued through the Court of Claims Act, 2743, waiver immunity was not unlimited. Article 1, Section 16 says suits against the state, and this is the 1912 amendment, suits may be brought against the state, comma, in such courts, the Court of Claims, and in such manner, maybe a statute of limitations, as may be provided by law.
Correct.
What sovereign immunity did the state ever have to waive after 1912, when it's in the Constitution, the state can be sued?
Your Honor, that exact issue has been addressed in two cases of this court decided 50 years apart. The first one was Rodewald versus State, decided in 1915, in which this court stated that Article 1, Section 16 of the Constitution was not self-executing. In 1968, I believe, before the Court of Claims Act existed, this court decided the case of Krause v. State, which decided the same thing, and I am not aware of any other case that says differently.
And I've read both of them, and you'll notice that it's just like a sentence or two that says that without any analysis. Here, it seems to me to be so clear, suits may be brought against the state. And if the state is subject to a suit, how then can it say, okay, we're going to waive our sovereign immunity and let you sue us? They don't have any choice. This is one of the right to remedy issues that Justice Pfeiffer has been arguing for a long time.
And I'm aware of your writings on those issues, Justices Douglas and Pfeiffer, but I have to revert to the Krause and the Rodewald cases as governing on this issue. And in particular, I should point out that the Garrett versus Sandusky case and the Bladen case dealt with political subdivisions, and I am not aware of any case that has raised the question with respect to the state of Ohio as to whether Article 1, Section 16 was self-executing.
You may have one today.
That's quite possible, Your Honor.
And I agree that those are political subdivision cases, Garrett and Gladden. And clearly, political subdivisions are not, the state is not a political subdivision,
right.
Is that correct? All right, so we don't have to deal with 2744 at all.
Right.
Only deal with 2743. And you say that 2743-02 was an effect by the state to limit. First of all, it gives up sovereign immunity, then it limits it.
Yes, that's right.
It gives up sovereign immunity, then limits its giving up.
Yes, and this court has approved such procedure in its Menifee case, which I cited repeatedly in our brief, in which you were in the majority, Justice Douglas. And when immunity is waived, the political subdivision or the state may decide to circumscribe or limit the immunity that it waives, and that is what the legislature did in this case with respect to 274302.
I must admit that I'm a recent knowledgeable person with regard to that second paragraph, because it just seems sort of stuck in section Article 1, Section 16. And I guess I leave it to the insurance companies to, in effect, bring it to my attention. You know, when they say the Sherrod case is a case that maybe was rightly decided, I have to look the second time to see what they're talking about.
And I certainly understand the debate on the issue, Justice Douglas. However, we would consider ourselves bound by the Supreme Court decisions that are directly on point on this issue.
Counsel, when you refer to the constitutional provisions,
two cases have absolutely
cases, and it's not self-executing, which part? That when they say it's not self-executing, I assume those cases said that until there was a provision for how you do it, there was no effective way, there was no, it wouldn't be that the claim, the statement you sued is not self-executing, that's a standalone proposition. But it goes on to say, the legislature may describe the man where you go.
Your Honor, in response, I would have to say that your scholarship in this area is no doubt a much more recent research than mine, since this was not briefed in this case. And I certainly would have been happy to have the
let's go to the man here. You're arguing that the statute that says the claimant can't be paid for any part of the award that was already compensated from other sources.
Correct.
I don't get it. I will put
you. That means then the state cannot be served made to pay under the Tort Claims Act.
Yes, that's correct.
Does that necessarily logically follow? It looks to me like that statute is designed to make sure that the claimant just gets a single bite of the apple.
That is one effect of the statute, Your Honor.
But how does that necessarily infer that the state couldn't then be liable for what somebody else had to pay to that person or the state's negligence?
Because in this particular case, we have to look at the insurance company as the claimant and determine what type of claim the insurance company is bringing. And as Judge Hayek pointed out in the Court of Appeals, it is bringing a subrogation claim. That's the only basis for the insurance company's claim when it is the claimant. It's the real party in interest only as to a derivative claim. And as the court also said, relying upon its previous decision in the case of Grange versus City of Columbus, when the collateral source rule is abrogated, as it was in this case by 274302, there is an absolute philosophical or fundamental incompatibility between the abrogation of the collateral source rule and the law of subrogation. The court said once the collateral source rule has been abolished, the very foundation of subrogation no longer exists. And the reason is that the insurance company no longer has a right to be subrogated to. In this case, Ms. Drumbarger never had the right to recover for her medical bills, and she never did recover in the court claims decision for her medical bills. And so her insurance company doesn't have that right either. It's well settled that an insurance company steps into the shoes of its insurer.
And how do we know that she did not recover?
It's in the Court of Claims decision, Your Honor, which I attached to my brief. Judge Bettis was very specific in setting forth the categories of recovery that she received. She did not recover for her past medical expenses. The insurance company argues that 274405B contains an express prohibition of subrogation claims, which of course we recognize, which has never been in dispute. But this court has also recognized in a number of cases that legislative inaction over the 24-year period that Lumbermans has been in effect cannot be looked to as a means of divining legislative intent.
Wasn't this whole thing designed to stop double recovery?
That's one purpose
okay.
of it, Your Honor.
And this would not be double recovery here. If any one of us had done this as an individual tortfeasor, the full claim would have had to have been paid, wouldn't it?
Yes.
But the state, because it's the king, can do this to citizens without any sort of right of the citizen to complain about that.
As this court has recognized in Menifee, when immunity is waived, it may be partially waived, and that's what has been done in this case.
But anyway, there wouldn't be double recovery here if they were permitted to subrogate.
That's correct, yes. And as a matter of policy, sovereign immunity was waived to help people and not insurance companies. The intent of the waiver of immunity was to make the state's coffers available to pay what insurance did not, and also to conserve fiscal integrity, as this court once again recognized in its Menifee case, and has been recognized in many other cases as well. And the purpose was also to compensate people and to make people whole who otherwise would not receive full compensation. The purpose was not to create a windfall for insurance companies, who had already collected premiums to cover these claims. In this case, the insurance company would be made more than whole by collecting premiums and also by being able to seek indemnification from the state.
Well, counsel, that presumes something that we don't know. It could be that when the insurance company decides how much to charge for medical insurance, that factored into that is the provision in the contract that says we can come in and subrogate and collect if somebody else caused this injury that's at fault. So if they do that, then they theoretically, in a large sense, would not be lucky.
That
would not be a double recovery.
That's true, Justice Blackburn. And as this court recognized in Menifee in response to a similar argument, insurance companies have actuarial departments that are able to calculate the cost of claims and the cost of premiums, and they will be able to make these adjustments as they have been able to do in the case of political subdivisions. We submit that the intent of the waiver of immunity was not to make insurance companies whole, but to make injured parties whole, and not to supplement the insurance industry, but simply to supplement, not supplant the role of the insurance industry. We would urge that you affirm the decision of the 10th District Court of Appeals, finally getting it right after 24 years and overruling earlier mistaken decision in the Lumbermans case.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan. Mr. Blumgren, excuse me, you've saved about a minute of your time.
Okay. thank you. As justices are aware, Menifee is a case interpreting 2744.05B and stating that the grant of limited immunity to political subdivisions from subrogation actions has been related to state interests and so forth. But again, that statute contains a specific prohibition against subrogated claims. We ask the court to look at the language of the two statutes. 2744.05B contains a prohibition against subrogation claims. 2743.02B contains no prohibition. If the legislature wants to prohibit subrogation claims, they know how to do it. They did it in 2744.05B. They did not do it in this statute. They had plenty. The Lumbermans decision was decided in 1976. The Quarter Claims Act was passed in 1974. The legislature's had plenty of time to look at this. There's been no amendment. The collateral source rule, I might add, was not abrogated by the language of 2743.02d, but only by the court decision in this case. We do not dispute that there can be a partial waiver of sovereign immunity, but we just simply say that it was not done in this case. 2743.02d contains no language prohibiting subrogation claims. The statute should be applied, not interpreted. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Baumgarten. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.